Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company, from seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The unstoppable stock market keeps on rallying. Tensions in the Middle East continue to simmer. Phase one of the trade deal expected to be signed next week. And digging into the buffer with our guest from Innovators ETFs, Trevor Terrell. All this and a few listener questions on episode number 644 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Well, another week has gone by, and here we are already approaching the mid part of January 2020. And yeah, I'm your host, Andrew Horowitz. Good to be with you covering finance and markets and working on our investment disciplines each and every week here on the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Before we go any further, I want to give a quick shout out to my good friends, Yvette and Bob. I want to wish them a heartfelt congratulations on their wedding this weekend. Just a wonderful couple that deserves the best of all things life has to offer. So congratulations to Yvette and Bob. Well, last week we talked about, we kind of questioned the whole idea of whether or not fundamentals matter. Fundamentals when it comes to the underlying earnings and economics with markets. And we looked at, if you remember, a few important trends and ratios like the PEG. We looked at PE, we looked at historical reference to see where we are, what was happening, and looked at where the markets were. Well, this week we're going to start to see if there is actually a connection or not, because we're going to be seeing earnings season getting underway and a whole host of economic reports that are pretty important as I see it. So we're going to be having the opportunity to check out exactly what's happening with many of the banks starting next week. Citigroup, Wells Fargo, JP Morgan, Bank of America, Goldman Sachs. We're going to also see reports from Delta Airlines, United Health Group. So it's a pretty busy week and a few that will really impact the Dow in particular. And we also have a pretty solid week of economic numbers coming out. We have, Starting off with CPI, inflation, consumer inflation. We have PPI, which is wholesale inflation. The beige book for the Fed is going to be coming out, retail sales, import and export prices. And towards the end of the week, we're going to see the University of Michigan's, or as they call it, the UMISH, Consumer Sentiment Index. This is going to be the preliminary number for January. So we'll see how there is the carryover of exactly if companies are able to meet their earnings expectations. That is baked into the market at this point and baked in with high expectations, and also how that squares with the economics that are coming out. We've seen a mixed bag. We've seen things that are pretty good in terms of the service index of the ISM, where the other side of the coin, the manufacturing side, has really been lagging pretty dramatically in a recession, and pretty much the weakest numbers we've seen in, what are we going on, 11 years for manufacturing right now. And we saw, of course, the employment numbers at the end of last week, where we have a 3.5% unemployment rate and a slight disappointment on the actual number that came out for the additions to the payrolls. Not so much of a disappointment that was like, oh my gosh, oh wow, look at that. No, that's terrible. No. But enough to say, well, maybe things are slowing down on the employment front somewhat. Again, nothing really to get alarmed at. The numbers are a little bit noisy, but missing by about 20 or 30,000. All right, let's see what happens. Let's see if this is a trend or an aberration, or if we're getting back to more normal levels of reasonable levels of employment additions, not the crazy numbers that we saw like last month that were just absolute blowout. And I think next week, the important thing we really have to be looking at in the beginning of the week on Tuesday is this inflation number, the CPI, because we're getting, I would say, close to the Fed's 2% target. This is the number that they've been telegraphing for the last how many years? I don't even know how many years. I mean, it's been forever that they've been talking about this 2% inflation number that they want to see. And we're getting close to that, but the latest comments out of the Fed have talked about moving to a different methodology. They're thinking about doing, I guess, what could be best summed up as an averaging, looking back historically at where inflation was. And if we do get to, let's say, 2.2% or 2.5%, they're going to look backwards and say, well, you know, we had about a 1.5% for some time. And now it's 2.5, so maybe we're at 2, but not over it. So they're going to allow essentially the economy to run hot. That's their words. All the Fed speakers have been coming out hinting about allowing the economy to run hot in order to make sure, I guess what they're really, really listen, what they're trying to do is make sure that inflation can be sustained at their 2% target. Now, whether or not you believe that 2% is something more than just an arbitrary number that they put out there and they're hoping to get to, and whether or not you believe that through the actions of lower interest rates, quantitative easing, they can really get there, is a whole nother story. Because we have seen the epic failure of negative interest rates in Europe and in Japan. We've seen the inability of the Fed to really push the idea of a 2% inflation rate, even though everything else seemingly lined up to keep the economy rolling, employment high, risk assets at all-time highs with their actions. But yet this pesky inflation number just can't seem to get to the level that they're satisfied with. So this is going to be next week. A lot of good information giving us a great insight. And we'll talk about that not only on next week's show, but also on DH Unplugged Tuesday night with myself and John C. Dvorak, 9 p.m. live, also available on iTunes, available on all of the areas that you go to find your fine podcast. And of course, you can always go to dhunplugged.com and check that out. So with that, I had asked earlier in the week, or actually not earlier, but kind of towards the weekend, hey, do me a favor. I mentioned this on the Twitter sphere. Give me your questions. What are you thinking? Let's see if we can answer some of those. I want to get to those very quickly before we get on with our guests, because there were some great questions that came on. And we're going to start up and tee it up with Steve. Steve asked, he said, what sectors or stocks that have historically benefited from election years? For example, he says, what about news media and companies that are going to see increased ad spending? So here's what my take on this. I think that there is a big question mark as to where the benefit will be. We do know that during an election cycle, particularly as we're getting closer to the election, there are all these campaigns and promises and platforms that are put forth that, hey, you know what? We're going to cut taxes, or we're going to put more money through infrastructure spending, or we're going to do things like lower your healthcare costs. All these promises that may or may not come true if a particular party or a particular particular person is elected, you know, depending on what they're talking about. What I can say is this, that there is the opportunity potentially for consumer discretionary if things line up pretty well with sentiment and with jobs that could, you know, potentially see a benefit if further tax cuts, particularly for the middle class, are promised. What about things like more spending? Again, helping the pocketbook of the average Joe and Jane out there. That helps consumer discretionary. Industrials are another sector that could be of interest. Think about, you know, the, I laugh because we heard about this and so many times and nothing happened with the shovel ready plans, right? There was all this discussion about, hey, we have all these, you know, we got the details, we got the plan, we're going to put into action all these shovel-ready infrastructure plans, talking about the aging bridges and infrastructure with roads and piping and just everything about the U.S. overall and how we're going to provide for these shovel-ready plans, maybe industrials, steel companies, which are, you know, really doing terribly, maybe they'll see a resurrection due to that. And I also thought it was interesting to look at the other side of the question. Those sectors of companies that may not do as well, because you have things like the idea that, hey, you know, when you have somebody campaigning on the idea that, you know, aren't you paying too much for your health insurance? What about those drug prices and those companies? They keep on increasing the cost of those pharmaceuticals on an annual basis. We're going to do something about that. Elect me. I will make sure those costs go down. And watch the healthcare, because they're an easy target. Easy target during a campaign for everybody to have the head shaking up and down with an affirmation that, yeah, man, those terrible, awful drug companies, we got to do something about those. They're going to be easily attacked, and I would watch those. But again, it all depends on what is the platform that's being pushed by any particular candidate. So keep that in mind. So I hope that gives you some insight into that, Steve. Adam wrote in, and he said, if the Fed's balance sheet is increasing by $100 billion per month, how many trillions of dollars will it have to accumulate before anyone notices? I thought this was a great question because it reminds me of that old story and the old question about if a tree falls in the woods and no one's there, will anybody hear it fall? So right now, we're being told that the balance sheet increase is not QE. Although, if it isn't QE, I'm not sure what it is, because it looks and feels like QE. And even at these levels, markets are definitely noticing. I mean, you just look at the correlation between the money that's been added to the balance sheet and pushed into the system and the rise in risk assets. I think there is a noticeable impact on that. I think probably the biggest issue is going to be if we eclipse the old highs of assets that are on the balance sheet by the Fed. I think there'll be a big question mark as to what's going on here. And you tell us that this is not QE, but what you're doing is QE. So I think that's going to be the noticeable factor. I also believe that, again, the opposite side of this question is what happens if the Fed starts to slow down on the pushing money into the system through the repo purchases and short-term treasuries, starts taking liquidity out of the system. There may be some notice by the market. So I think that markets are appropriately noticing this and investing along with the idea that the Fed is going to be there for some time, continuing on with this plan, adding liquidity, et cetera. So I do think it's being noticed, but I don't know if we have to get more than the high, which was over 4.2 trillion or so, 4.3 trillion in the previous high not too long ago, that there's going to be, I don't know if it's going to be outrage, but there's going to be some people that are going to be very concerned about this. Next up, Jake wrote in. He said, what banks do you like going into earnings next week? That's a good question, because banks have had a really good run. I mean, we clearly see that the banks, ever since the yield spreads have, you know, the curve has changed around a little bit. We see a positive slope to the curve. Spreads have widened out a little bit. The yield curve overall has been much more positive. The problem is, I guess the only thing that I could say to you is, you know, expectations seem a bit high, you know, ahead of themselves. Not high, but I would say ahead of themselves. And when I think about that, and I look at the stocks that are reporting next week, I would have to say that maybe, and I say this with some trepidation and some reservation, probably the least expectations for any of the stocks, the major ones that are reporting next week, is for Wells Fargo. We know all the problems they've had. We know that obviously there was a management shift, and there's been a lot of trouble with the ability for the company to gain a lot of, or gain back a lot of the good faith they had, because a lot of things they did with their accounts. So that may be something to look at, as expectations are pretty low going into earnings. JP Morgan would probably have to really impress significantly to see much more upside during this earnings report. We're seeing all-time highs, give or take, for JP Morgan right now. Probably the best performer of all of these names over the last number of years. And they'd have to continue performing pretty well. I mean, I think they're priced to perfection right now. Now, I still like Bank of America and even the setup for Citigroup. Now, here's one that's a wild card. Bank OZK, the old Bank of the Ozarks. Now, if they can clean up their act and show a bit better net interest margin or NIM, there's some potential here. If you look at the chart on that and look at their past performance and look how they've lagged significantly the entire sector, something of interest there. Obviously, they've had some difficulties because of some questions on some of the deals they have. The net interest margins have been dropping. Recently did a little bit better. Keep a look at that, Bank OZK. Now, I'm going to mention this, and I want you to understand this. These are just observations. They're not recommendations. We don't make recommendations of any individual securities on this show. Just being very clear about that. But answering your question, some of the things that I'm going to be looking at next week, I think that we have to, at this point, pay particular attention to the technicals on all of these because that will really tell the story in a time where fundamentals are not as important at this point for many of these names and for the market in its entirety. Now, Nick wonders whether or not this MJ or the marijuana ETF that's been hovering around $16. He says, I have a bunch of shares at $30. Should I buy? Will it go lower than $16? So Nick, the chart looks absolutely miserable. The long rat tail of the downtrend is incredibly strong. Now, what I saw recently was some basing in the chart. There was some hope that, wow, New York is going to legalize and put it across the board and mayor, governor, and there was some comments and all this good stuff out of it last week, and it hardly moved the needle at all. And one of the reasons is that the sector needs to consolidate. The sector got well ahead of itself. Expectation this to be the biggest moneymaker of anything that eclipses technology earnings because everybody wants to smoke pot, right? And everyone wants the legalization. You know, all the stories that we heard going into this. But a lot of these companies are all chasing the same thing. So I think right now that there's a lot of companies, a lot of overlap in what each of these are doing. And I think that there needs to be this consolidation. And from the chart, I would have to say there's a wild card move and maybe a wild cat. And definitely a speculative play, in my opinion. It does look like it's basing pretty well along this $16 range right now. So is it the worst case? Well, you're down 50% right now. I'm not going to say to you, hey, you know what? Why don't you double down on this? Watch the chart again. I sound like a broken record on this. But watch the chart. See if it starts to break up. Look for the resistance break. And if it does, in fact, not only break that downtrend that we saw that has been going on for a long period of time, but if, in fact, it could start getting some legs and hold on, moving a little bit higher against the grain. Now, Lori asks, he says, there's a conventional meme, used to be conventional wisdom, now it's a conventional meme, seems to be that the U.S. dollar down, EEM, or emerging markets up, inflation up, long-term bonds down. U.S. direction is key to the story. What is your take? I got to tell you, I've been thinking for a while, and we've been kind of at the drawing board and researching and looking and trying to understand the relationships. They're somewhat tied together, but yet not. Obviously, we need the global growth story to reignite and the U.S. dollar to come down, and I do believe that if that is the case, you could see a really good move on emerging markets. And EEM, the ETF that is representative of the emerging markets. And yes, you have higher inflation. You know, what's going to happen with long-term bonds moving lower? Those are all very much part and parcel to what we talked about 2 weeks ago and some of the themes that I laid out for 2020. And emerging markets have a good amount of catching up to do. Clearly, emerging markets have been lagging for some time, particularly the U.S. and to a degree, developed markets around the world. I think that the chart looks really interesting for emerging markets, but there is, again, a good amount of, I would say, underlying growth that has to start coming out rather than just talk about the idea that there's this, that, you know, there's this basing that's going on. And this is the bottom. This is the end of the slowdown. There has to be some real fundamentals that change. Now, one of the things you want to notice is that inside the EAM ETF, there's four key countries that hold about 60% of the holdings. So you have China at about 35%, Korea at 11%, close to 12%, Taiwan about 11.5%, and India 8.5%. So that's 34, 44, 50. Yeah. So we're calling about 60% plus on those four countries. China being 35% of the overall basket that's being held inside of that ETF. So China has been struggling, obviously, as we know, due to a slowdown in their economy that's been pressed upon by the trade war, the tariffs. Yes, we are signing a phase one skinny partial deal next week, supposedly on the 15th, with China. But yet at the same time, what is that going to say? First, I have no idea because nobody knows. Second, it's being told to us that they're going to be buying agricultural products in the $40 to $50 billion per year level and also a total of about $200 billion worth of goods over the next 2 years. We know that the December 15th tariffs didn't rise. We know that there has been some other tariffs that came down, but essentially the rest of the tariffs that were put on are still there. So China needs to really get not only above the level of where they were and get from under the heel that's on their throat right now, which is the tariffs that we're putting on their economy. Once that, and if that happens, I don't know when that's going to happen. Recently, President Trump said that he is pretty okay with waiting till after the election results to do anything with the phase two, which deals with the important points, which in theory, if we got through that, would have a reduction in tariffs again. But until then, it seems like we're going to have the continuation of tariffs moving into most of 2020, possibly for some political reasons, a retraction and a lifting of some of the tariffs in some of the areas to hopefully keep the markets up. Don't forget, they're very concerned, this administration, with keeping markets up to make sure that things in the economy do well, people's wealth is intact going into the election. And one of the things that they can do is potentially lift tariffs and make it look like they're getting some progress on the next phase of the trade deal, which will deal with intellectual property transfers and technology and company transfers and intellectual property rules. And hopefully, as we're seeing, although not agreed to by China, a change in the way they deal with state-owned enterprises. I don't think that's going to happen. So I believe that. The other thing is that is part of this question, and I'll mention to you, that we're also not going too far out on the curve as in terms of risk, in terms of yield, in terms of the length of bond related to maturities and durations. So we're keeping a shorter duration, shorter maturity on our bond exposure within portfolios because I just don't see any reason to go too far out on the curve as risk reward doesn't seem to set up in a way that makes any logical sense at this point of the cycle. So there you go. I want to thank you very much for those questions. And I thought maybe at this point now what we'll do, we could keep them coming in. Of course, you can ask anything you want over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. The Ask Andrew button is always available to you. Just click on it and ask away. But right now, we are going to segue into an interesting topic of buffers. You'll find out more about this, and I'm going to find out more about this because I have a few questions to ask. Let's get right to it. And with us today is Trevor Terrell. He's with Innovators ETFs, and a lot of people had questions about this that came in through the listener emails and the Ask Andrew, and I thought that I'd bring him on because I started looking at these, and I have questions. So, Trevor, hey, welcome aboard.
Hey, thanks for having me.
You know, the Innovator ETFs, the first time I ever heard of them was back when you started working with IBD, right? The IBD 50?
Right.
And that's kind of an emulation of their IBD 50, and I think you do a variety of things to try at least to get close to what they're doing with their 50 top stock picks, and they're on and off, you know, when the market's in correction, when the market's in rally mode, and all that good stuff. But what I want to talk about was this whole new area that you've really kind of gotten into, which is, what is it, like an offshoot of the structured product market?
It pretty much is, yeah. So it's more or less a liquid structured product. You can kind of look at it like that, just with, you know, the liquidity, the transparency, and a lot of the benefits that the ETF structure provides. So we've got to get into details of that, but you tell me how you want to go.
Yeah, well, we can start from the beginning because, to be honest with you, I have a lot of questions here. And I mean, I have a lot of materials here, but the thing that you have, they're called buffered ETFs. And kind of give me a little bit of, let's step backwards and talk about maybe, you know, the genesis of where these came from and the idea. And in a general standpoint, I think, you know, how do these actually work?
Sure. Yeah. So maybe from a high level, why we brought them. So, you know, talking to financial advisors every single day and clients, you know, if they went to their client, what would be their perfect investment, right? Obviously, they would want all the upside, right? And none of the
and
downside.
No downside. Yeah, no, I hear that a lot.
It's zero downside, right? So, okay, well, if that's our framework of what the expectation is, right, in a perfect world, how can we make that, you know, how can we get as close to that as possible, right? And the structured product industry, as well as with what annuities provide, has come as close as possible to getting you exposure to the market with some definitive level of protection, right? And whether or not you're taking on credit risk is a different issue. But, you know, so we looked at those different industries and we said, how can we leverage the ETF vehicle, which we're huge believers in? Our founders here at Innovator actually started PowerShares, which was bought by Invesco. Mm-hmm. Back in 2006. So how can we leverage the benefits of the ETF structure? So working with a group called Milliman Financial, SIBO, as well as S&P, and really like a year and a half process with the SEC to make sure that we did everything possible with the regulators to bring this to market. We were able to finally bring the first buffered ETFs with Innovator out in 2018. And really what they are, Andrew, is it gives you one-to-one exposure to an index, right? Whether that be the S&P 500, Russell, NASDAQ, even internationally with emerging markets and international developed, so EFA, but you get exposure to the market with a definitive amount of downside buffer. It can be anywhere from 9, 15 to 30%. And obviously that level of buffer or protection comes, you know, at a cost, and that comes in the form of an upside maximum potential. So that's really what you're getting. You're getting exposure to market and you're essentially putting, you know, bumpers, so to speak, or guardrails on your exposure before you even put that money to work.
So let me just understand this and say this in a different way, or maybe the same way, but the way my mind thinks about this, okay? What you have basically is a limitation on part of the upside and limitation on part of the downside up to certain points, depending on which particular one you choose, which because you could choose which way to go, right?
Exactly, yep. And the other thing to think about is the time frame too. So that exposure is over the course of a year. And with these being inside of an ETF, everything's going to rebalance. And every single year, it's going to reset your buffer level, your protection. So it's over the course of 12 months, your exposure, whatever index that is. So pretty straightforward.
Well, that leads me to another point, but I want to just remind me about that for a second. We're going to talk about the different dates, the different monthly issues that you have. But so, you know, from your literature, you talk about these various layers. You have layer one, which is index exposure. Now, it's synthetic. There's no actual real core investment in here. These are all developed through, you know, options and synthetic types of investments to give you that exposure. Is that correct?
Yep. It's seven options positions. It's all synthetic. You're right. And really, the first four, it basically gets you that synthetic long exposure to the market. the next two positions, that's your put spread. That gives you the downside buffer, whether that be at 9, 15, or 30%. That's up to your choice, but really that's the position that gets you the protection. And the last piece comes in the form of selling a call, and that really dictates your upside cap or the maximum potentially you can make over the next 12 months. So really that's financing the protection and brings it to a zero cost strategy.
So now when I go into this and I would say, oh yeah, I love this idea and I wanted to do it, would I have to choose the, let's say, January edition, or can I choose, let's say, the November edition?
So either one, right? So it's an ETF. There's intraday liquidity. You can buy any one that you want. Obviously, you're going to make sure that your upside potential and your buffer are what you're looking for in your profile. So we always encourage people, for simplicity's sake, to buy as close, you know, to the beginning of a new issue or when a new outcome period is about to, you know, rebalance or start. But technically, there are going to be some tactical opportunities inevitably that happen throughout the life of the product. So whether it be the November series or the April or January, whatever it is, any 12 calendar months, you can buy at any point throughout any trading day. It really just is a matter of understanding your exposure to the market and what that current outcome or defined outcome is going to be. And that's why we built a lot of tools on our website to really analyze the market. That way investors can say, hey, I'm looking for to maximize my downside protection. I want to maximize my buffer, or I want to take advantage of a tactical opportunity at the end of the year. What gives me that best profile? What is my current outcome? And so that's at innovatoretfs.com. It just kind of depends on what you're looking for.
So, but now one of the things in your literature talks about when you look for the downside risk protection part of it. So, you know, let's for a second put aside the opportunity to move up because, okay, that's what people want to do. They want to make money, right? Okay. So inside the literature, it talks about the Innovator S&P 500 Buffer ETF, which is designed to track the return of the S&P 500 up to a predetermined cap with a buffering while buffering investors against the first 9% of losses over the outcome period before fees and expenses. So let's put aside fees and expenses for a second. Let's just focus in on this whole idea of, you know, the first 9%. So let's say I start with $1,000. And I invest in, let's just say it's January to make it easy. And does that mean if the portfolio, or let's say the S&P 500 is down 20%, I don't lose on the first 9, but there's another 11% downside potential?
Yep, market's down 20, you're down 11.
Okay, I got you. And so this is why you'd want to potentially go into the other ones that have a greater downside buffer. So there's a 15 and a 30, for example, but that limits your upside as well, right?
Completely. Yeah. The more, you know, the bigger the buffer, right? You're going to give up some more to the upside, which is why we see the upside cap higher on the 9% compared to the 30. There is one thing unique specifically about the 30%, Andrew. So the 9 and the 15 are straightforward. You're protected from the initial value. So 0 to 9, 0 to 15, you're protected right away. That's when your buffer starts. The 30%, however, we actually slide the protection down. So to start at -5 and then go to -35. So what that means is if you invest in that, you're actually exposed to the first 5% of loss.
Oh, it's upside down.
Then you actually have from anywhere from -5 to -35, you're protected. So that's a total of 30% protection. So for instance, if the market's down 40, you're down 10. And obviously, as you can imagine, the reason we did that was because that makes the upside cap higher and a little bit more competitive, because that first 5% of protection and options are very expensive. So we figured people would be willing to pay that, like almost like an insurance product.
So now what's the upside?
The premiums you're going to pay for that protection.
What's the upside cap on the first product, the down 5%?
Down 9%. So we have a 9%. So the cap is the only thing that changes in these, right? Mm-hmm. Month over month, anytime they rebalance, and that's driven by, you know, rates and volatility at that time. So this January, the 9% was at 13.5. The 15% was around 9, and the 30% was around 7.5-8%. So right, for the year.
This reminds me of the fixed annuities that we call equity index annuities, right? Where, or even some of the variable annuities out there that have a form of protection, although they do it in a little bit of a strange way where they, you know, mandate the annuitize it over a period of time. But the equity index annuities have a very similar thing. The difference is that they guarantee, I guess, by the insurance company, absolutely no losses. However, you know, they may be only giving you 6% of the upside, and they do it in a they do it on a monthly rolling basis where they do a monthly returns and they divide the total returns over the year or a point to point.
Right.
So this is kind of a monthly point to point, it would seem to me, because you're rebalancing each month. So therefore, if I get in mid-month in this situation, so if I get in, again, let's use January, and let's say January is for a January annual, of course, right? But let's suppose that January dropped and dumped 10%. And now I get in today. Is it from today through the following, or is it for the 1st of January to the 1st of January, or the 30th of January, 1st of January to the 30th of December?
It's from the 1st of January through the end of December.
Right.
And, right, I mentioned the tools that we have on the website, right? So if the market were to drop 10%, you're not going to be down 10%, right?
Right.
Because there are technically 364 days left in that contract.
Mm-hmm.
So the price movement is going to be muted both to the upside and the downside out of the gates, right? Until those options get closer to maturity. The one thing that you know for sure is, like, at the end of that contract, at the end of 365 days, you are either going to, you know, meet or exceed the performance of the S&P 500, right? As long as, with the only exception being if the market were to blow through the upside cap, right? So if the market's down, you're buffered. So you're not going to be down as much as the market. If it's in between where it listed in the cap, you're going to be right in line with that. So, and if it blows through the cap, then you're going to be stopped. You know your maximum potential for that 12 months before you put that money to work.
So who is this really based for? I mean, it's not for the trader, right? It's not somebody who's going to be, be some people out there that are doing some fancy footwork and trying to figure out if the January has maybe an edge over the March and maybe looking to do something there, somebody with, but let's put that aside, okay? You know, who is this for?
This is for, I mean, we're not the ones that created defined outcome investing, right? I mean, annuities have a place for a reason. Everybody's looking for downside protection.
Right.
These are for the people who see us at the top of the market and have no idea what to do, right? This allows you to be wrong. That's what it does. It allows you to stay invested in the market, and before you put money to work, you know exactly, you've eliminated a definitive amount of downside risk. But really, it's meant to be bought as a buy and hold strategy, right? Because these are contracts.
Mm-hmm.
However, there are tactical opportunities along the way, but really, these are meant to keep you invested in the market, make sure that you don't have another 08 situation. And if you do, give you a tool that's not going to lock you up, you know, for, you know, 5+ years. It's not going to be layered with transparent and non-transparent fees, right? It's, everything is right there in front of you. It's 79 basis points for the S&P versions, right? And you can get out at any point in the day. You can buy it after breakfast and you can sell it before lunch. I mean,
but if you're
that's the beauty of the structure.
I have a question for you. It's an ETF version, but still, the more money that pours in, the more you have to utilize within the portfolio, right? I mean, it's not like a mutual
fund.
That's
the nice thing about the
ETF. Yeah.
We can create new shares, right? We can always create and redeem shares out of the market based off buying and selling. And when that happens, right, let's say there's a million share buy that happens on day two of new product, right? And we only had, 50,000 shares to begin with. Well, all that happens is we go out and buy the exact same options, the exact same strike, exact same maturity, and they go in the portfolio. So we can create the shares, and it just continues on trading.
But if I'm the guy that's in the beginning of the month and something wacko happens and somebody comes in and buys in and they're paying a differential in the premium that was paid, how do you then structure the portfolio to be even for everybody throughout the year?
So it depends on when you get it. So the guy that bought day one, right, he gets the initial values, right? I mentioned the 13.5% cap on the 9%, right? With a 9% buffer. If I got in day one and you didn't, and I got that value, you'll say you come in at day five.
Yeah.
And the market's gone up 5%. Well, I'm up 5%, right? So if you buy when it's up at that level, mm-hmm, instead of at the initial value, your buffer, you have 5% of downside risk before the buffer would even kick in for you, right? Because the buffer starts at the beginning of the outcome period, at the beginning of that 12-month window.
Yep.
So when you buy, right, you're buying the same option, but it's appreciated. So for me, if I put new money to work, I'd be just like you, right? I would have a 5% risk to the downside, and then 9% from there, as opposed to me when I got in day one, I start with a 9% buffer. And if the market goes down, I have protection right away.
So a question for you, is there any logic in theory? I'm throwing this from the gut here, sure, without any analysis, but go through monthly. And if I got a gain, let's say 3-4% for the month, just whack the January and buy the February.
Happens all the time.
Right.
And that's,
am I onto something here?
Locked in gains.
I'm onto something here, right?
Yes. Yes. You're very onto something. Yes. Without a doubt. Yeah. Lock in the gain, from January or whatever month it is, and reset your buffer and get a brand new cap. We call it stepping up,
right?
And resetting your exposure. Yeah. You're definitely onto something. We see that happen all the time.
So there's gotta be some aberrations in the market that you've explored that this stuff just may not work perfectly right. And it's gotta be something, a skew event. It's gotta be, you know, VIX goes bananas and option pricing becomes really wacko. Now, of course, you're doing both sides of the option, right? You're doing some buying, you're doing some selling on both sides. But there's got to be, and not all, the options market is not necessarily fully efficient. Let's also realize that. Is there some scenario that may cause you concern that, you know, you may not get exactly what you thought?
No. And we actually do a full trade breakdown of every outcome period that, you know, finishes its 12 months, right? But regarding the options market, the variable is going to be, first off, your user experience over the course of that 12 months, right? Somebody not familiar is going to buy the ETF, have the downside protection. Well, there's time value in an option. So you're going to lag. You can actually trade down into the buffer level until, you know, in the interim. So you have to realize that. But as far as buying the options themselves, it is very efficient. We actually leverage our partner, Milliman Financial Risk Management, who are options experts and actually do a lot of the sub-advising for the large annuity companies that are out there. But these are SPX options. You're talking about the most liquid options market and the deepest options market that's even available to us. And because it's a static basket, Andrew, and we're not trying to go and manipulate and optimize anything throughout that 12-month period, it's pretty straightforward. You're buying the exact same basket with the same strikes and the same maturities on an ongoing basis. However, we're just going to take what the market gives us.
Yeah.
And so with the only variable being from January to February all the way through December, every time that a new issue completes its period, we go back to the options market. And with the final piece going to sell a call, right, that is going to be the only thing that changes that cap. The buffer is going to reset every single month back to its 9, 15, or 30. But the cap's going to be different. So that January example, I told you the 13.5 cap.
Yep.
Back in going into 2019, you know, we had Christmas Eve, one of the worst days of 2018. There's a lot of volatility. So we saw a 22% cap in the 9% buffer in 2019. So wildly different from what we had to start this year.
Interesting. So who is this not for? I mean, this is the person that's looking for unlimited upside, very young person, doesn't care about
the driver.
This is not what?
This is not meant to be an alpha driver, right?
Right.
This is meant to complement. This is meant to complement what you're already doing with your, you know, your core exposure, right? Because you're limited to the upside, right? And regardless, all things being equal, you know, there's an expense to these things. And I will say they're options based. So you're trading without the dividend, right? You're not entitled to the dividend when you're buying these options.
So you're not getting total return concept of the underlying index. You're getting just the raw value of the price appreciation.
Exactly. That's correct.
And what about the taxable nature of this in terms of forms that you send out? You send out K-1s or is this a 1099?
No, 1099.
And is there any other UBTI or...
There is not.
Something?
No UBTI, right? So we, with these portfolios, we've been fortunate to work with, we're the first to do it.
Right.
However, we've worked with the SEC and obviously the IRS and our partners. Really, your only taxable event going forward is going to be based off when you buy and sell the product, right? And look, I'm not a tax professional, I'll throw that hedge out there, but you know, your tax consequence going forward will really be based off of your cost basis when you buy and sell.
So now,
because
we're
able to leverage. Go ahead.
What's gonna say? If I buy, let's go back to what January 1st. I buy January 1st, right? I have to sell December 31st, or can I let that roll?
No. Let it roll and everything
is going to reset. So then I can sell it on January 3rd and get a long-term capital gain as an example.
Yes, you can. Yep. It's all based off what you do, not what anybody else does.
Right. So, and then like you said, liquidity, if, you know, markets are theoretically down a certain amount, I didn't lose money. Let's just say it's a 5%. Let's say the 9%, the market's down, you know, 8%. So I take my money out. I didn't lose a darn thing, supposedly, right? In this, within that period, it could be a little bit different for different circumstances. But let's say I didn't lose any money. And then I can just obviously take my money out. No harm, no foul on that whole thing, right? And then I can go maybe when I feel it's appropriate to reinvest in another month moving forward. Now, why would I do something like, if it's January, invest in a April? Because I want to have a shorter year or something?
So what'll happen is when the market, so we actually have a chart on our website of the S&P 500 with all of the
give everybody the website address.
Yeah, it's innovatoretfs.com. Okay. And you'll see a tool section just in the top. And I'm going to talk about the second one in the drop down, which is called our timing tool. And really, because there are so many of these trading, it's a good visual of just, all right, what has the market done over the course of 12 months and where are each of these different series trading currently? And you look at that chart and you can see really when the market were to drop down, you know, after the initial outcome period, let's say 6 months in, if you see it drop down even close to one of those horizontal lines, you might want to buy that particular ETF because you'll have the opportunity to get really the same pricing that it had back on day one with the exact same parameters. The only difference being is your time horizon has shortened up significantly. So some people who want a buffer but don't necessarily want to take on the, you know, a year isn't a long time, but if you want a shorter maturity, you have the opportunity to do that based off of what the market does. So, you know, that's just a good visual. In order to kind of analyze every single series that's been launched.
Pretty fascinating. I got to tell you, we're going to look further into this because, you know, we've had clients over the years that obviously have said, you know what, I want to be, listen, a lot of clients say that they want that holy grail of, you know, upside opportunity. And no, well, they want to make everything they can, but no risk, which is obviously, you know, they even chuckle when they say that. But there is something to be said about certain clients, certain people, certain investors who, especially now, especially where we're seeing a lot of froth in the markets and saying, you know, hey, what do I do? And for the most part, you know, what can you do? Well, you number one is diversification. Let's just get that straight, at least from my side of things. The second thing is to have alternative assets. I'm putting you in an alternative asset class. And I'm saying that, you know, you have some alternative assets where you can get some upside where maybe it's uncorrelated necessarily from the markets because you don't have any correlation to the downside down to 9%. So that whole correlation is whacked. You have upside correlation and tight, you know, so in other words, the downside variance is not even applicable in your studies, right? So right. This is something, right. You know, that could be I'm very much interested in those people that are thinking, hey, maybe I don't really want to invest, but I really do want to invest. You know what I'm talking about, right?
Yeah.
I don't want to invest, but I really do.
Like I said, it's great. It's like, what if you're wrong? Everybody has their call next year, right? And a lot are saying single digits, really, you know, there isn't a big spread in the calls that are going to happen for 2020, right?
Right.
We know that those could be wrong. And that's what this does. This allows you to be wrong.
Allows you to be wrong.
Be in the market.
Huh, interesting.
Yep.
Trevor Terrell, who is the head of sales and responsible distribution and marketing efforts across the institutional national wirehouse, registered investment advisor and regional independent, now a podcast star from Innovator ETFs. I want to thank you so much doing this from the Newark airport as he's about to take off to a warmer climate. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Appreciate it.
All right. Great. I mean, that's, you know, we try to bring some new things onto the show at all times and new concepts and new ideas. And I thought this was pretty interesting when I started looking at it. I got to tell you, first of all, let's get this on the table. We did have a good discussion there, but I think there's probably a lot more questions that need to be answered with regard to these buffer ETFs. I don't think we covered all of the specific details on how these worked or really the underlying, you know, things that you need to really get to understand. And I would encourage you to do your own research on this and get a better acquainted with all the different caveats that are involved, because there's a lot of little areas that I think have to be questioned in terms of the timing of when you get into them, how long you have to hold them to make it the most rewarding or to gather the greatest downside risk, all the things that may happen, and also some potential, we'll say, some stress analysis to see if this is something that can work. Also, like anything else, there's no magic in a box. So I'm going to, with this, as I tell you all the time, do your own research on this. It's not a recommendation. I have to look into this more to see if it's something worthwhile to even continue looking at. But again, just something that I thought was new and interesting to really get a little bit more detail and acquainted with. I want to thank you for joining me. It's going to wrap up the show today. Make sure you do, in fact, check out all the things that are available on thedisciplinedinvestor.com. We'll be posting some of our quarterly outlook and update and commentary on the site coming up. If you are a newsletter follower, if you will, if you have, in fact, put in your name to get updates, well, we'll send you an email probably about that in the next week or so. But we'll get some of that out on the Disciplined Investor as well. Thank you for joining me, and I will see you again next week. Bye-bye. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training.